I'm not a zoologist and I'm not an ecologist. For those of you that know me, I'm a mum on a mission. I'm a mum that got depressed about her son's future on planet Earth and thought, actually, let's just do something, Kerry. I don't care what you do, but off you go. And so that's when Sussex Green Living was born. And now I'm an obsessed mother on a mission. So, before I hand over to those that are more an expert than I on environmental gardening, don't look so frightened, Natalie. All I wanted to actually say is that, you know, climate change hasn't been talked about really throughout 2020. We know the reasons why. Climate change or the climate crisis has been addressed temporarily by COVID and the changes to behaviour that have taken place over the last year or since March. But that's not a permanent solution to reducing our carbon emissions. So here at the Horsham Climate Cafe and at the Horsham Future Forum and all the other things we do with the Repair Cafe, we're all about really trying to educate, inspire, and encourage people to make changes, permanent changes. And before I hand over to Natalie, I just wanted to explain highlight sort of one example of a wildlife friendly garden that I've really become aware of since going to a wildlife gardening workshop in Abersay. And it's actually around the sort of web of life, but in relation to a certain species, which I'm going to share with you. So a lot of people have got very distance from nature and from the natural world. But throughout COVID, we know that people have found nature. They've enjoyed nature. Families have got together and they've been out walking, cycling, and really experiencing nature and appreciating it at last. So we now need to look after it. We are part of the web of life. We think ourselves superior to all the other species that we share this great planet with, but we're not superior and we are wrecking it. And I just want to show you one creature that we would like to try and help and support. So web of life, we're part of it. We're not at the top of it. And with the human race in mind, one stat I just wanted to share with you is when I was born, and I'll tell you the year, right? It was 1965. Don't I look good for my age? The population was half that it is now. The population has doubled since I was born. And when I was born, yeah, we were a lot greener. We weren't as greedy. Consumerism and this global world in which we live, where everything that we buy is shipped all over the world. Our clothes, our belongings, our food, it's shipped all over the world using fossil fuel. So it was half the population when I was born. It's twice the population now. So, you know, it is a serious situation and we need to do something about it. But what I want to share with you, if my computer, oh God. Oh, these were just some beautiful photographs. Just some beautiful photographs that are very, very wildlife friendly gardens. A lot of people throughout COVID have started to grow their own food. Certainly have become aware, much more aware of where their food has come from and where they're buying their food and all the packaging they're buying their food in. So let's make these changes last. A lot of people have, really appreciated the natural surroundings. There are lots of mental, physical benefits for being out there with nature. So here we go. What am I? Come on, who's going to tell me? What is this? This is all about wildlife-friendly gardening. Who's going to put their hand up? Turn on your camera if you want to tell me. What is this? Come on, Carolyn, put your mic on if you're going to tell me.
It looks like a little bat.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say.
There we go. Isn't that cute? Doesn't that look so cute? That's not the image of a bat we would normally see, though, is it? I mean, that looks really, really sweet. The image of a bat we normally see is something more like this. It's really very frightening, and lots of children, actually lots of adults, get quite frightened when they see a bat flying over because it's at night and they fly really fast. But why are bats? Why are bats a really important part of our natural world? They're pollinators. So lots of people don't think about that. A lot of people are aware and really worried about the bee population, for example, from a pollination point of view and for the welfare of the bees. But a lot of people don't think of bats from a pollination, you know, as important pollinators. And when I did this wildlife friendly gardening workshop, they told me a stat that really quite shocked me, and it made me change my fish pond that had like goldfish in it. It made me change my fish pond from a fish pond to a wildlife friendly pond. I gave all the fish to my brother. We cleared out during COVID. We cleared out the pond and we refitted it out, and it is a wildlife pond. And within a few months we had great crested newts, which, you know, are relatively rare. But one of the reasons I did that is because on this course, they said to me that actually, unless you've got a pond, a natural pond like that without fish, you won't have all the sort of mosquitoes and the insects that you would have with a wildlife pond. And a bat needs about 1,000 mosquito-sized insects an hour to survive. So I would not have bats in my surrounding area unless there was a natural pond that encouraged those insects, that provided that sort of level of food for the bats. And unless you've got the bats, then obviously you haven't got that sort of the web of life. So when we think about pollinators, we do think about the bees. The reason I wanted to say that, I'm going to stop the screen because I'm not really doing this presentation. Oh dear, someone's disappeared. The reason I wanted to actually just show you that is just to say, look, you know, we're one part of this web of life. We've got to think way beyond, you know, our stomachs and our little green spaces. And one fact actually that Tony Whitbread told me this morning when he supplied me, I was trying to persuade him to do the intro rather than me, is that our gardens, the space of our gardens, all added up in the UK, are bigger than all the nature reserves in the UK. So it is really, really important that we green up our gardens, that we provide the right sort of environment for wildlife. We provide wildlife corridors with hedges and gardens that can connect, that the hedgehogs can get from street to from garden to garden and field to field, and that we don't just block off our patches and say, this is my patch, no one else, you know, may come in. We've got to think beyond ourselves and beyond our gardens and think about that web of life of which we should be sitting within and not in a pyramid at the top. So that's all I wanted to say. Tony Whitbread would have said it much better than I. But now, first of all, I would like to invite Natalie Carroll from Coolham Blooms. Natalie is a friend. Her children went to the same school as mine. I'll let her introduce herself fully, but she's a mum on a mission with a huge passion for nature and her garden and wildlife. She can tell you all about it. After Natalie, we'll be listening to Joanne Knowles, who's going to talk about her passion, some would say obsession, with peat-free Sussex. So Natalie, over to you. You might have to take your mic, you're on mute. Let me escape out myself. Sorry, I'll stop screen share.
Am I on mute still?
No, you're all right. You're away.
Okay, and I'm just trying to share my presentation, right? Let's see.
Well done.
Is my screen showing?
Yep.
Okay. That's right. Hi, everyone. My name's Natalie, as Carrie said. And I am a mother. I was previously a hospital pharmacist, but because of life and priorities, I was spending more time at home, and gardening has been my sanity saver for many years since I moved to Coolum. And so I'm not an expert at all on ecology or anything like that, but working with nature, you do pick up good habits, and hopefully, you know, I can spread some of the things that I have learned along the way. Right. So, I want to see if I can minimize. Right. I want to just touch on, at the moment, what I do is I grow flowers and I sell them to people. And although it's not the main part of this talk, I just wanted to let people know the figures of what the cut flower industry is worth. So basically, cut flowers are worth $865 million a year. And of that, only 14% are British flowers. So this luxury item are being flown from places like Africa, the Middle East, South America. And, you know, we're very good at thinking about food miles, but what about flower miles? By the time your flowers get to you from either the florist or the supermarket, they've traveled about 20,000 to 25,000 kilometers to get to your home. So it's just making people aware of, you know, the distances these products, which are luxury items rather than food, have traveled before they actually get to your home. The other thing with just making you aware of imported foods and the consequences with them, many of them are actually treated with chemicals like silver nitrate, which they use on the cut flowers to extend their shelf life so that they last much longer at home. They hybridize the plants so that they don't have fragrance, which obviously is not great, and because they say fragrance shortens the flower's life. Usually farmers, when they intensively farm, they farm only one crop. So they'll all grow roses or they'll grow carnations. And because there's a lack of diversity amongst the plants, you get lots of problems with pests as a result, because there's no diversity. And because they're pests, they then use more chemicals to the plants to then try kill the pests so that they get a better crop. And the other thing to think about is often these flowers are grown in third world countries where obviously labor is much cheaper, and are they actually getting a fair wage for the work that they are doing in order for you to have these lovely flowers that are grown far away? So that's just a completely different thing to think about as well. So I'm Coolum Blooms, and I've only got it's a small cutting garden within my garden. I started it thinking about it in the 2018, where I was given some large timbers, and I've made a raised bed, and I bought the bulbs and started to plant bulbs. I sell directly to people in the neighborhood. People, friends, word of mouth, things like Instagram. I've also started to sell to some local florists, which is really good because people are starting to think about where these flowers are coming from that they're using. But obviously it is seasonal, so I don't have flowers in winter, and florists who have shops have customers that they have to serve all year round. So from my side, in winter, I'm going to do things like growing lovely indoor bulbs in pretty pots and vases and things like that, so that people they've got an option and don't have to go for a bouquet of flowers if they want to give a gift to someone. And also starting to grow flowers that can be dried and then made into wreaths and things like that in the future. So locally grown flowers, obviously there's no air miles, which is a huge benefit. They're better for the environment. As Carrie said, all of our gardens, if we have eco-friendly ways, will help the whole of the environment because they are larger than any nature reserve. I also don't use any plastic packaging. I rather use glass jars and pretty ribbons and compostable paper. I don't use any chemicals to enhance the shelf life of my flowers. I try to grow things that are fragrant, chemical-free, things that don't travel well because then obviously large-scale growers can't actually transport those. And also it's good to support local, as we all know. Some of the things that I've learnt in all my readings, because I'm self-taught, is there are natural ways of fertilising your plants. You don't have to reach for all the chemicals. Obviously, creating your own compost at home, which is a topic in itself, but obviously compost is feeding your soil, giving rich matter for decay, and also helping water retention with your soil, which is important for the plants. Using things like, there's plenty in my garden, nettles, to make a nettle tea, which helps your plant to thrive in the beginning stages of the life cycle. Making compost tea, which all of these things are quite smelly and you want to keep them quite far away from anywhere where you are spending a lot of time. Compost tea is using some manure and making a large stock with some nettles, and you let it ferment for a while and then you actually feed the soil because obviously you're giving good bacteria to the soil. Comfrey tea is another way of helping the plants grow and thrive and therefore, you know, survive any attacks from pests and things. I meticulously undo all my tea bags because I'm a big tea drinker, because roses are said to be very fond of tea leaves. So tea bags, I'm sure everyone will know, have a lot of plastic in them. So I use actually clipper tea, which doesn't have plastic, but I still empty all the tea leaves into a bowl and then I go around the garden and scatter the tea leaves around the rose bushes. And they I must say, are flourishing as a result. Other people use things like banana peels, which are high in potassium, and they either put the banana peel when they are planting the rose, or they might just actually put it under a little bit of soil next to the plant. If anybody has fish tanks at home, the water from the fish tank, obviously it's got the effluent from the fish, is really good for your plants. If you dry any coffee grounds, those are very good for acid-loving plants. So not all plants, so your ericaceous ones like your rhododendrons and your camellias and azaleas and things like that. Using your cooking water, once it's cooled down, that could be used to feed your plants. And then also things like using the ash from your wood stoves, but obviously not if you've used any fuels and not charcoal as well. But what I read is don't put that on acid-loving plants, which are your ericaceous plants again. Then in any garden, unfortunately, they're going to be pests which attack your plant and make them not as beautiful as you would like or productive as you would like them to be. But there are natural ways that you can repel those pests. So one of the ones that I have used is to use really dilute liquid soap. So just a little smidge of, I use my fairy dishwashing liquid and dilute it in like a spray bottle, and then you spray your plant, whatever is getting infested with a bug, and that suffocates the bug, which is still getting the desired effect, but I guess it's not the chemicals, which is the main thing. The other one I read, I haven't used it myself, is to use oil mixed with a bit of soap and then diluted, you know, considerably more, and then spraying that. And basically, I think the oil coats the bug and therefore it can't breathe and dies. Then it's also using things like chili flakes and garlic solutions, where, you know, obviously the pungent aroma or the burning chases the pests away. I read about using a tea made of the thyme leaf, which is supposed to be good for white fly on cabbages. I haven't grown cabbages. Then using just simply breaking up mint leaves. Apparently ants really hate mint leaves, so that's quite a good way of getting rid of ants, so, and you know, quite pleasant smelling fact for us. And then slugs, which are the bugbearer of, I'm sure, many a gardener. And we all try ways of trying to, you know, minimize their effect on our beloved plants, especially when you grow them from seed and you nurture them for so long. And then a slug comes and munches up your flower, which is heartbreaking. With slugs, what I tend to do is when my family eat eggs, I use the eggshell and I bake it and then I crush it and I spread it around the base of the plant, hopefully making a little barrier that helps prevent, you know, the slug slithering across and getting to the leaves to eat it. Other things that people use is they put Vaseline around the pots or salt around the pots. Things like you can see in the garden centers, copper wires or copper tape, which apparently gives them a little bit of an electrical shock. You can get wool pellets, which you can sprinkle around the base of the plant. Some people use beer traps where they'll cut a plastic bottle and dig a little hole, but they leave the bottle protruding out of the soil a bit. So I think beetles and things don't get trapped in it. And then they put beer, and apparently the slugs like beers. And the thing I'm actually going to try next year myself is a biological way of trying to combat slugs. And it's called Nemaslug, which is actually a nematode, which is a type of worm, and it directly targets slugs, which is obviously good because it's not harming anything else in your garden. And it purely kills the slug. It's a fridge line product, so it's not available from garden centers at all. And you tend to have to buy it online. And from what I've seen is you mix it up in water and then you water your flower bed, and it lasts for about 6 weeks. So obviously when the plants are very small, if you're growing from seed, it's very beneficial in that time, because obviously as the plant gets bigger, it can obviously, the damage isn't as fast as when it's a small seedling. The other natural way of trying to minimize the effect of pests is companion planting, which I will go on to now. Oh, and I meant to say, all the pictures of all the flowers, they're all flowers that I've grown in my garden. And also that's just food for thought, because obviously we also used to having flowers from, you know, the supermarket and that have flown so far. And as you can see, you can grow beautiful flowers in England and they obviously don't have any of the large environmental effects when they're just transported a few miles down the road. So next, I just wanted to touch on companion planting, which is a very useful way of also trying to eradicate the pests that might be attacking your favorite crop. So it's basically trying to achieve a natural balance. It's aiding pollination and trying to keep the pests down. It usually involves using very strong smelling plants like mint, sage, basil, lavender. And what they do is they mask the scent of your crop so that it actually misleads the pest and the pest doesn't find your crop that you're trying to protect. Because I was reading somewhere that a carrot root fly can smell your carrots from a mile away. So by planting one of these companion plants, it's less likely to find your carrots than somebody else who hasn't done the companion planting. The other way of companion planting works is to grow brightly colored flowers that are flat, because they then encourage things like the butterflies, the lacewings, and the ladybirds, which then prey on the bugs that are obviously affecting your plant. So by growing those sorts of flowers, you will then encourage, you know, the decline of the pest in your crops. Companion planting might also be some certain plants actually grow better in close proximity to one another than if they were growing separately in different parts of the garden. So they call those soulmates. And then the fourth way that companion planting might work is to actually grow something almost sacrificial, like lettuce that the slugs are going to chomp away at to protect something else that you don't want the slugs to eat. So it's almost having a crop to give to the pest. So I've done a few examples, and online you will find loads about companion planting, and it's a lot to do with vegetables. I haven't grown many vegetables. I've grew some tomatoes, which are still very green, and I'm wondering if they are going to ripen this season. But there's a lot about companion planting that you can see online. But one of the things that I thought is quite interesting and might be useful as well is when you grow things in pots, so like basil and mint, they were talking about growing them in pots, you can actually move the pots around. So that's even more helpful, because if one plant is getting attacked by some pest, you could move the pot there and then protect that particular plant, rather than necessarily planting it throughout your flower bed and things like that. So those are some examples of things that might work together and obviously be able to protect your crop. And some of them are really beautiful, like lavender is fabulous and obviously going to be encouraging the bees. And calendula is very beautiful as well, which you could cut and have some in your house, and nasturtiums as well. So it's almost a win-win. You're protecting your crop and you're having something for the bees and something you could enjoy in your home as well. Water, as with climate change, everything's going to be getting hotter. There's going to be even less water. Water is a precious resource, as we all know. So some of the ways that we could approach that is by growing drought-tolerant plants. Obviously, you still need to look at whether the plant is suitable for your type of soil, whether you have heavy clay like me, or is it chalk, or is it sandy? So you still need to check, and obviously the amount of lighting in the area you're wanting to plant. But maybe have a think about drought-tolerant plants as an option for using less water. Reusing grey water, like I know I use my tumble dryer, but I have three children. All the water is in a tank, and then I go and always pour that water around the garden or in my pots or something. So providing the water that you're using from your house doesn't contain any bleach or disinfectants, it should be safe to use it in your garden. Watering at the correct time of day is really, really important. You want to water your garden if you're going to water your garden at nighttime, because at nighttime your plants will then have the entire time to absorb it without having to worry about evaporation and things like that. The worst time of day, obviously, to water your garden would be in the middle of the day, because it's just going to evaporate because of the heat of the sun. Also, when you're watering, think about where are you watering. You want to be watering the roots of the plant. You don't want to be watering the leaves. You want the water to be getting to the part that needs it, which is the roots. So always water the roots of the plant, not any other part of the plant. Another thing that I was reading, which most people will know is really important to retain water in your soil, is to mulch. And they suggest to mulch at wintertime so that you're actually retaining all the water from winter within the soil, so it isn't evaporated. And also, if like me, you've got lots of bulbs, obviously you don't want to be putting all the mulch on top of your tender bulbs as they start to grow, which I always go, oh dear, there my bulbs are coming up. The other thing, if you're growing anything in pots, have you got a saucer under your pot or a tray under your pot? So obviously as you water your pots, the water isn't lost. It can be drawn up again from the saucer by the roots of the plant. Just to be aware that established plants don't need frequent watering. Only really your new plants and your seedlings are the ones that you need to really worry about watering. Obviously, another one is water butts, having a water butt to save water. And I was reading about how, you know, everybody's paving their gardens these days, and that's also causing a problem because you're getting a lot of surface flooding of areas because of all the paving replacing grass and things in people's gardens. So if you are going to do that, they suggested to use water permeable paving so that obviously you don't get that surface or flow of water. Then, as Carrie said, attracting wildlife to your garden is really important because all of our gardens are adding to the benefit of the environment. Have a break from mowing, which I'm sure many people would probably enjoy that idea, because clover, which will flourish in your grass, is a really good nectar-rich source. Rather plant indigenous plants as they provide a better habitat for our wildlife. As Carrie said, introduce water for bats, as she was saying, and all the little insects that live in the water. It's also good for bees, frogs, and newts. If you're going to have flowers, which most of us do, some are greener, as you might say, than others, and they are often labeled plants for pollinators. So look out for that label on the garden center plants, because they will be a better source of nectar for the pollinators. Have an area of your garden which is a little bit messy, which in my garden is quite a lot of the area. I always warn people it doesn't look like a landscape garden from Garden and Home. So have a messy area where you might have some weeds which are great for wildlife. Also there might be sticks and things which give homes to other wildlife. Then the usual things like feed birds, have bug hotels, and introduce things like climbers up walls and fences. Just give an alternative place for creatures to live. So those were different ways of increasing the amount of wildlife in your actual garden. Then we all know that obviously gardening is really good for the environment. We're aiding the greener spaces, but there's a lot of things that we use in gardening that isn't so environmentally friendly. Apparently there's like 500 million plastic pots in circulation, which is take 400 years to break down. So I tend to wash and reuse my pots. So obviously hoping to reduce the amount of plastic I'm using. Upcycle packaging from your strawberries, your yogurt pots to plant seeds, and using the inside inner cardboard part of toilet rolls for things like sweet peas and runner beans. Use soil blocks. I've got some, I can't remember what they're called, and they're little, almost like pellets of soil that you put in water and they swell. And they've got a little netting, it isn't netting, it's papery stuff around it. And then you plant your seed in that, and then as they get to a stage that you plant out, you literally pull away this outer kind of casing and plant it in that little plug of soil within your garden. So obviously you don't need to have as many pots. When you're buying plants, maybe think about bare root plants where there is no packaging. It's cheaper for you to have it posted because it isn't as sizable. And obviously there's no plastic container adding to the environment's plastic load. Obviously, growing from seed is even better because you can have hundreds of plants in very little plastic usage at all. Other plastics that gardeners use are netting. So can we rather use jute or string or metal instead of plastic netting? Then other things that we use plastic are like labeling, which I'm very unsuccessful labeling mine correctly. They often, the names just wash away, which is very annoying for me. But I saw on Instagram someone was using bamboo sticks and wine corks to label their plants. So I've been saving all my husband's wine corks, and this year I'm going to use my kebab sticks or some sort of stick and put the wine cork on top and write my label on top and see if that works any better for me. Obviously, watering equipment is not very environmentally friendly with our plastic watering cans and our water butts, which are plastic. So maybe next time you're ever needing to replace things like that, maybe think of metal, which it is more expensive, but perhaps, you know, it may be longer lasting and it obviously isn't adding to the plastic load in the world. When you buy tools, is there some you can get from someone else, a secondhand one? Does it have to be new? Or if you are buying new, can it have a wooden handle rather than a plastic handle that's FCS wood? Just things like that. Compost bags, whether it's peat-free, organic, whatever, the plastic bag the compost comes in is another source of plastic. Are we able to use it in the garden as a weed suppressant rather than buying more landscape fabric? And just trying to think about ways of using these plastic items more than once so that we can, you know, reduce the plastic load that the world has. So that's all that I had to say. I just wanted to thank you for for your time listening to me. And I have got some resources at the end. I don't know if anybody wants to read further. These were some of the resources that I used in preparation for this presentation. If you need them, I'm sure Carrie might be able to, or whether if this is recorded, you can access it that way. But I'm sure Carrie will be happy to send you the presentation if you'd like to do any more reading.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed, Natalie. That was absolutely enlightening and brilliant. And what we will do is we're recording it. We will actually share the recording with your PowerPoint presentation and any other content from Joanne using a blog. We'll share out with everybody. So is it okay if I hand over to Joanne and then we deal with any questions at the end? And at the end, I know Joanne and Mark would like to share what's actually going on with raising the critical awareness about the climate crisis. So they'd like to share some news at the end as well. But if I invite Joanne now and then we do questions about Natalie's presentation and Joanne's there afterwards, is that okay?
That sounds good to me. I'm just trying to sort out my very short screen sharing, and let's see what happens if I do that. That looks good, but apologies everyone for my lack of practice on. Oh no, okay, I think I might give up on that one. Hello, my name's Joanne Knowles. I live in Cowfold, and over lockdown I have been doing a lot of gardening, and I thought that I would I've always been interested in why we use peat, because it's such an amazing resource. I was surprised when I went out to buy some peat-free compost that the garden centres, once they're open, were full of peat-based compost. And actually I had to dig around to find the peat-free stuff. So I've been trying to figure out how to change this in Sussex. There's been quite a bit of work done already. And there's a great campaign for peat's sake being run by the Organic Gardening Association. I'll give you a bit of background on peat. I'm not an expert, and all the details I'm going to share have come from the internet. I've checked facts and tried to use reliable sources, but if you think anything sounds suspicious, please let me know. Then I'm going to talk about my plans and pick your brains a bit for ideas and contacts. So first, a quick poll. Does anyone, how many people use peat-free compost? If you could click on the reactions button at the bottom and just give us a thumbs up if you use peat-free compost at the moment.
So just hover along the bottom of the screen with your mouse, and the bottom right, you'll see reactions, and you can just click.
Okay. And then, sorry, everyone, I'm still trying to, that's it, right. And then, I wonder if I could do the screen sharing. It's so frustrating not to be able to do it. Let's have another go. Anyway, so, and then I'd also like to find out how many people only buy plants grown in peat-free compost. This is a lot trickier because it's not always obvious, but I think if you are concerned about it, then possibly like me, you've been asking garden centres which are the plants that are grown in peat-free compost, and they don't always know the answer. So has anyone had any luck with that? Peat, as you probably know, is the remains of plants grown over thousands of years. Their carbon is stored underground and underwater, and that's what's key about it, is because it's underwater, it doesn't return to the atmosphere. But once the bogs are drained, dug up and bagged for our gardens, the carbon is released. Peatlands in the UK are internationally and nationally important habitat, which supports rare and threatened species, including the curlew, some of the bats that Carrie was talking about earlier, lapwing, merlin, whimbrel, snipe and brown hare, and lots of other animals. They're also highly important for their invertebrate population. So we are losing, species are becoming extinct all over the world, but in the UK still we're losing hundreds of species. Britain's peat bogs are in serious danger. Centuries of drainage for farming and digging for fuel have damaged or destroyed over 90% of the UK's lowland bogs, which are irreplaceable. Peat harvesters, on the other hand, will say that it's a sustainable source, and that they, although they're typically removing 22 centimetres in the areas a year, in the areas where they're harvesting. And it may be true that it's possible to return to some level of repair in around 10 years, but it takes so long for peat to form. It grows at about 1 millimeter per year. It cannot be regarded as a sustainable material. Scientists say that it may take a century or more for these delicate environments to return to fully functioning wetland habitats. Other experts think that the damage is irreparable and that the original level of biodiversity is lost forever. What is true is that the peatlands in the UK and across the world are an incredible carbon sink. Peatlands are also an important water store, holding about 10% of the world's global fresh water. The UK currently, we gobble up about 3 million cubic metres of peat every year for horticulture. 30% is used by professional growers, but 69% is destined for amateur gardeners, predominantly as multi-purpose compost and grow bags. And about a third of what we're using in the UK comes from our own peatland still. And we're also taking it from Ireland and from other peat bogs in Northern Europe. Peatlands contains one of the world's most important carbon stores. And once they've drained, the carbon is released back, as I said, into the atmosphere.
Oh, I think we might have frozen. Let's hope Joanne comes back. Just give her a few minutes. So Joanne, if you can hear me, one solution is perhaps to turn your camera off and just see if you can speak. That might reduce the bandwidth if you're able to do that. She lives in carrot crunching country in Cowfold, so reception's probably a bit debatable over there. I don't think it's going to help. Sometimes if there's lots of us, we actually turn our cameras off, but somehow I think it's Joanne's end. We'll just see if she comes back.
I'll ask a question to the previous presentation, Karen.
Do.
Yeah. Sorry, what was the bit about the banana peel? You just can plant it next to the plant, is that right? Oh, sorry, I'm mute.
Each
Hello, there we go. Yeah, actually, Carrie, it was your neighbour who told me about the banana peels, and I actually read it again. So you can actually plant the banana peel when you're planting the rose, whether it's bare root rose or a rose in a pot, underneath the plant, so deep within the soil. Or if it's a ready planted rose in an existing flower bed, you could just dig up next to the rose a little bit of soil, put the banana peel under and then bury it again with a bit of soil on top. And it's the potassium within the banana peel skins that are really good for the plants.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, but I think you definitely have to cover it up, because I think what all the wasps and things like that would also come, which may not be, we all have a bad reputation for wasps, but yeah, they're also pollinators.
Thank you. Welcome back, Joanne. Do you want to unmute yourself and continue?
Okay. There you go. Sorry, apologies. I have no idea what happened there, mid-flow. So are you happy for me to carry on? Is that working okay now?
Of course.
Absolutely. Thank you. So peat is a natural... I'm just trying to find where I am. But it has natural antimicrobial qualities. But it kills off the natural microbes in the soil, which makes it very difficult to grow glorious flower gardens or a bounteous crop of healthy vegetables. The problem is that healthy soil contains millions and billions of busy microscopic microbes that decompose plant matter, suppress pathogens, reduce erosion and runoff, and prevent soil compaction. So live soil is really key, and peat is not live soil. It has been killed. It is completely inert. This makes the nutrients more available at a plant roots. So using peat is not a good idea for the environment, not a good idea for the global carbon economy, but it's also not a good idea actually in your garden. It's just that it's a very cheap material, and there is a process by which it can be got to our gardens, and getting people to change, as we all know, is challenging. So on the other hand, using good stuff for growing your plants, promoting microbial growth, actually helps control harmful pests and diseases, and keeping the bad guys in, the beneficial microbes, keeping the bad guys in check. Unlike microbe-rich compost, peat moss is low in nutrients, and as it decays, squeezes out many of the tiny air pockets in soil, making it hard for roots to breathe and expand. So what should you use in your garden? There are lots of great peat-free alternatives, and getting the right stuff for the job is the key to success. The John Innes Institute has developed many years ago recipes to make your own, and these are all on the RHS website. They call for sterilised loam, and I'm not sure, as we've heard, that killing all the microbes is considered now to be the best plan. But most are good, and using a peat-based substitute based on bark, wood fibre, coir, bracken and green compost means that less chalk is required if you want to have a go at making your own. The recent Witch Report, gave top marks to Sainsbury's peat-free compost. And I'm working with Olus, the company in Henfield, who take all of the Sussex green waste. And they sell a bagged peat-free compost under the name of Heritage Products. I'm working with them to improve or change their range a bit, to add to their range. And they're also looking at a bag for life, which is something that we heard a bit about earlier. So you would take an IKEA size bag into that they supply into your garden centre, where you can fill it up with compost from an open area. So this happens already in some garden centres, and they're hoping to bring this to Sussex as well, which will be amazing. But if you have a big enough garden, or you're a member of an allotment association, Olus will deliver large ton sacks quite reasonably. I think it's about 60 quid for a ton sack delivered, and there's a, you know, that take you a while to get through that, and it's a great soil conditioner. So how do we get Sussex peat free by the end of 2021? I'd love some help. And please, if you're interested in getting involved, put your name in the name in the chat and your email address, and I'll sort out getting back to everybody. And any ideas, suggestions, comments will be gratefully received. If anyone has any contacts, that would be very useful. I did a Freedom of Information request just to check that our local councils weren't going against the grain and using lots of peat. And you'll be pleased to hear that all seven responded and that they are they're doing really well. So there's Horsham is the least well performing. But I'm going to share the results with all of them so that they can see how everyone else is doing. And I'm hoping that will be the prompt for Horsham to improve a bit. And that's mainly around buying in plants that are based grown in a peat based medium. Garden centres is a really key to, is one of the keys to this, that's for sure. And how do I get them to focus on peat-free composts? And I think that's going to have to be consumer pester power. But they will put articles in the newsletters, and I have a template for stickers that are grown in peat-free media, although getting them to print and use that will be challenging. But if anyone has any garden centre contacts, it does make it so much easier to approach a company, and I'd be very grateful for any names. Consumers, apathy busting talks to schools, horticultural groups, environmental groups, and anyone else that might be interested in getting involved and making sure that we do stop using peat-based compost. Group newsletters, I'll be doing articles for newsletters, and press. Does anyone have any contacts with any journalists? Social media, and I'm also looking, I'd love a celeb to get involved. I've written to Sarah Raven via her press department. I haven't had a response from her yet, but if anyone knows any other famous Sussex gardeners of any repute that might lend their profile, I'd be very grateful. Sussex nurseries, Sussex plant growers, that's another prong of the attack, is getting them to go peat-free and supporting the virtuous circle, where if Sussex garden centres are looking for peat-free grown plants, and Sussex nurseries are growing peat-free plants, then suddenly there is this wonderful circle where we're buying local plants in Sussex which are grown peat-free and like to live in Sussex. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Does anyone know any commercial plant growers that I can get in contact? As I say, just having a name makes it all a lot easier. I've put my email address on the chat, joanne@trenchmore.co.uk. And if anyone would like to get involved or has any ideas, please, please get in touch. I'm sure there'll be more. This is just the start. So thank you very much for listening. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joanne. That was brilliant. And I'm sure it's quite an eye-opener for everybody. We're a relatively small group, so why don't we just sort of open it up to, if you've got a question, maybe just raise your hand and then we can invite you to ask the relevant person your question. Or you want to add something to what's been talked about today, either is fine. No questions?
I find it quite amazing. So if peat is not actually good for the garden, why on earth are we using it? I mean, as a gardener, it's unbelievable that it's been something that we've been given for however long, and it actually is already the right source.
I think we've learned more, haven't we, as time, you know, microbiology of soil is something we still don't know enough about. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there are all these amazing microbes living in our soil and that they are helping plants to break down that, to extract the nutrients in the soil is something that we're learning about. So it's, but seeds don't need a very rich, as you'll see if you do look at the RHS, they don't need a very rich compost medium to grow in. So, it is fascinating.
I guess it was easy to extract, like everything else, hence making it cheap to be able to sell big profit margins. It's what it's all about, isn't it? Yep. Barbara, did you have a question?
Yes, it's sort of just a comment, really. I've been trying to get peat-free organic compost, and it's like gold dust in all the nurseries that I've been to. And I managed to find a nursery down in Peacehaven that did organic peat free. But when I looked into it with the peat free, it was one of these ones where they used soils that have drained from peat areas.
I know.
And although they aren't actually deliberately going in, getting that from what they do is they drain off all the nutrients into the soils.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
And not actually digging it up the peat itself. And again, I was questioning whether you could really call that peat free or not. I suppose technically you could, because you're not digging up the peat from a peat area.
Yes, and that's how they've got their organic certification on that, is to be not dug up peat. But you're right, it is we're finding ways around it instead of coming up with great alternatives.
I think they used it to, because of the silt building up in lakes and rivers, they actually are providing a solution, and then that byproduct of that solution they're then selling off.
Yeah.
Is fine, unless it becomes a driver for to have more peat extraction and so on. So it's a bit of a nasty circle. The other thing I did when I was having a look, there was a farm in Cumbria that was wool as part of its compost.
Yes,
lichens. How good is that?
Well, it's a shame. We were going to have a shepherdess on today to talk about wool as a slug
deterrent.
But that hasn't happened. She couldn't make it, unfortunately. So So I think it breaks down really well, and you know, it just adds some an element of what's required for plants to grow into a compost, into a potting compost. I've seen good things about it. I haven't tried it.
Because I know that this year the industry was supposed to have stopped using peat compost.
That's right, yeah.
And they, because they've left it up to the industry to do the work on it, it hasn't been done. So I'm really behind you on all this. I think it's really
brilliant.
The other thing is the organic aspect. You know, with gardens, if we're just making our gardens pretty, the nice flowers and things, we don't really need to use those chemicals.
No.
And they had, Dave Goulson at Sussex University did a study couple of years ago now, and he looked at some of the local Sussex nurseries and garden centres, and looked at the way the plants that they were selling had been produced, and especially the ones that had stickers, the RHS stickers saying bee friendly or whatever the terminology was, and he found that nearly all of those plants had been produced chemicals which are actually harmful to bees.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And they actually still reside in the compost and in the plants. So when you're buying them from the garden centre, you're effectively buying a death plant for a bee. It's attracting the bee, and then it's killing it off.
Yeah.
Or it's certainly having a harmful effect on them. So he was saying, again, trying to source plants and seeds which were organically grown, and trying to encourage people, when gardeners, when they're doing your garden, don't use chemicals on it.
Yeah, no, definitely. There is a list of potting media from the Soil Association that has a lot of different, you might have already found it, which I could put onto the chat, so thank you. Yeah,
no. I'd just say that Gemma, I think, has been waiting to speak.
Mm.
Yeah. Hello, thanks. I was just going to say, I think I read that it retains moisture, so that's why they like to use it in compost. So whether that's the same wool, the way they're using the wool as well. But it was interesting what you were saying, Barbara, about the using the runoff, the nutrients, because I read also that once they dig into a peat bog, then even if they stop, everything starts washing away from the bog. It'll carry on. So once it's disturbed, that's it. It's ruined completely. And another interesting fact I thought to share is that 30 centimetre deep peat bog holds the same amount of carbon as a hectare of rainforest.
Wow.
Yep.
Really interesting.
Actually, Gemma, if you can add that to the chat, and if there are any links that you're talking about, like the Soil Association, etc., if you add those to the chat, we will put it in a blog. Anyone fancy writing a blog for me? No volunteers?
Sorry, Carrie, I'd love to, but I've got a busy week.
So anyway, if you give me the links and information like that, Gemma, we'll add them to a blog, and it might not be well written, my friends, but I will share it with you. I'll do my very best just with everything that's going on. The lady, the shepherdess that Joanne was talking about, her name is Fliss. She runs a little enterprise in Horsham called Wool Shred. And yeah, they've got a flock of sheep shocked by not being able to sell on the wool to any source. And basically it would have been composted. And that's how Wool Shred came about. So they shred up the fleeces, they sell them in Hessian sacks. And yeah, you actually put them sort of around your plants. So it's a bit of a mountaineering exercise for the slugs. It helps while the plants get off the ground, and then yeah, it rots down into the soil. So she also makes chicken poo. Caroline, here's one for you: chicken poo and stinging nettle fertilizers. Very smelly, very good for the plants. We can all make these. Does other people have comments to make or questions to ask? I know Alison should share Horsham Transitions, or Transition Horsham even, CD, etc., the days that, you know, we haven't got dates, but the allotment.
Yeah, okay. I'm part of Transition Horsham Community Allotment, which is on the Cheswith site. And we have kept going just about during these interesting times. And actually, people have been quite involved, and it's we're actually now able to expand slightly. But we do generally organise something called CD Saturday, which is either the end of February or the beginning of March. Has recently been associated with a kind of living show, where we provide an opportunity for people to swap seeds in the same way as happens in Brighton and several other places. We also have on occasion done something called Seedling Saturday, which is an opportunity for people to swap those seedlings that they have planted and perhaps have rather more than they would like of one thing, but they could swap something else, which we're hoping will take place early in May. And then we are also involved in product swap, which is the eventual output of the allotment. And we're hoping that that next year will be around about this time. In fact, it probably will be this very Saturday in a year's time. So anybody who's interested in that, if you could put your email in the chat and just say you're interested in the community allotment, that would also be great.
Fabulous.
And we are as far as you can be on an allotment site, we are organic, but there are limits to how organic you can be on an allotment site.
One of the things that Alison and I were talking about, Mark, you'll be particularly interested, and we've been talking about how we reach out beyond the greenies. Many of us in this room, virtual room, are very environmentally concerned and aware, and want to reach out beyond the regulars. And Mark came up with a suggestion of Horsham Market, having a stall in Horsham Market. The attraction of doing that throughout the winter, and with COVID looming as well, is quite unattractive, really. but what Alison and I did touch on is the idea of having a stall. Basically, we are currently developing, we are going to develop it, a sustainable pop-up roadshow to go out to the communities and to go out to Horsham Market, any market, out to schools and out to the villages to get out to meet everyday people. And it's a milk float, an electric milk float, that's going to be converted into a sort of an eco home, along with an incredible woodland theatre vehicle. And what Alison and I were talking about is perhaps at the point of seed exchange, seedling exchange, produce exchange, we could have a stall in the market or a couple of stalls in the market with the seed exchange, seedling exchange, and these this pop-up sustainable roadshow. But we'll need supporters to help us. But those are some of the ideas that we're floating around at the moment. Now, if you've got any further questions, please pop your hand up. Otherwise, I will ask Mark or Joanne to speak about, to give us a bit of an update on Extinction Rebellion, who are doing a sterling job to raise the profile of the climate crisis that has been so forgotten this year by so many people, and can't be, for the sakes of our children, our grandchildren, future generations, and all who we share this great planet with. So
enough of me. Can I let Mark step up for that?
Go on, Mark. Give us a rundown. How are I was with Extinction Rebellion on Tuesday afternoon, running around getting Vaseline and suntan lotion and shuttling injured people to the railway station and scavenging BMX bicycle wheels for their boat. So I sort of did a little bit. I'd like to do more, but how are they doing? Oh, you're on mute.
Mute, Mark.
You're on mute. Are you going to share the picture or shall I?
You could share the pitch, that'd be fine. Thank you.
Okay.
As you know, Extinction Rebellion exists. We get a little bit stressed at times, mostly because of that figure I put in the chat recently, which said more than half of the CO2 emissions in all of human history have come out since 1990, since the first Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change pointed out there might be a problem. So that gets some of us a bit stressed and we feel we need to act at times. There's been a lot in London this week. One of the things you might have noticed in the local paper, a boat has been pushed from Brighton up to London. A little boat called Greta stayed the night at Colliers in Horsham on Monday night. Key thing for that is it's a carnival on the move, but it's trying to make bring to your attention the fact the number of climate refugees that exist in the world now. That's refugees caused by climate change. It's 25 million now. In 5 years' time, it will be 50 million. So, you know, people in Extinction Rebellion feel we have to keep bringing that to everyone's attention. And that boat's travelled up from Brighton through Horsham, Crawley, and then up to London. There's a picture of it. Sadly, about an hour ago, while it was still in carnival mode and just travelling down the street, it was stopped by the police and is now no longer in with XR and has been taken by the police, which is disappointing, but it will probably bring us a bit more line to the newspapers, we hope, although that's hard work these days to get a good story in the newspaper on this topic. And the campaign will continue this week in London. It will be a bit... Perhaps less will be going on in London this second week, but there will start still something to be happening in London. So that's what's happening. We're concerned about the climate emergency, and we just try and do what we can. Hopefully it works. And the other item I could bring to your attention is something called the Climate Emergency and Ecological Bill in Parliament at the moment. If you could follow that CEE bill, that asks our MPs to act on our behalf with regard to making good decisions on the climate emergency. Anybody else want to chip in? Feel free.
Joanne, you've been with them over the last few days, haven't you? Joanne, did you, or Morag? Sorry, I've got an email from Mark here somewhere. I was just trying to find with a photo of it up in London. I could have just literally looked online, couldn't I? Here we go.
Yes, I was with them when they were in Horsham as well. And I have to say, it was very gratifying, the response from the principal of Colliers on the Tuesday morning. He came along to the car park at about 7 in the morning with a couple of other suited gentlemen. And I said, I expect this wasn't the sort of first day in your new job that you were expecting, really, was it? And he said, no, I was a bit surprised when I got a phone call at 9 o'clock last night. But he was so cool and so genuinely concerned. I think when I expressed the view that, you know, I'd be happy to include something in the West Sussex County Times and to say it could be a great opportunity for Colliers to embed it as part of the curriculum, perhaps, as, you know, it's geography, it's history, it's politics, it's all those things, economics, it's all in the bundle. And I said, I'm happy to put whatever you want in. And he said, oh yeah, there's a strong eco group at Colliers. So that was very encouraging. So it made me feel as though if Colliers came on board with it, it could be a pivotal moment in my wildest dreams for Horsham, because we are so conservative and so comfortable and so scared that I thought if something, you know, a fine upstanding institution like Colliers comes on board, then that could be reassuring for people to think that it's not just scary hippies that are trying to wreck their lives. It's somebody who's really seriously concerned and wanting to do good things and help, really.
I'd love to get his details. I've actually tried with our Youth Eco Forum and with all of our activities to engage and to get to the pupils of Colliers and key members of staff. But I've although I've met the odd lecturer with pupils at an awards ceremony where they'd won a sort of an environmental award, it didn't go any further than that conversation. I really I've struggled. I've tried to use the social media. I've tried to go through the reception. So it would be outstanding if we could find a way to get the message. It shouldn't be this hard, should it?
To their email address, Carrie. So I can. He gave me his personal email address.
Oh yeah.
So all that right. I could include your information when I contact him.
Yes, and tell him about the Youth Eco Forum. Yeah. They want new absolutely. Members. And there's an exciting event that we're planning. The Youth Eco Forum are planning. We've applied for a grant for an amazing event for young people in the Haven at Clive, the guy that's built the environmental theatre.
Yeah. Right.
So that's a potential free event and education for them to get involved in.
Yeah. Okay. I'll speak to you about that.
Fantastic.
The other thing that was quite encouraging was that the police were very accommodating, you know, as much as they could possibly be. And the message was, no, you can't all camp on the fields here overnight, but give you permission to camp in the park across the road just for tonight. And very gratifying, obviously, that there was not any mess. Mark and I were there clearing up other people's rubbish as well as Extinction Rebellion's bits and bobs that were left over. So it was nice to be able to think this is in total contrast to Bournemouth Beach or the Travellers or whatever. It was really successful in lots of ways, but obviously very downplayed in the media, sadly.
If we think about this time last year, you know, we saw the largest movement, you know, that had ever been seen in the world for the climate crisis. And obviously this year we've hardly seen anything, but yeah, we all need to work hard together to reduce our carbon emissions. And I think we're probably drawing towards the end and people are hopefully not falling asleep yet. But I popped up, can you see on the screen? So forthcoming events every Tuesday, you can't see it? No, stop sharing. Okay, let me just stop a share. Okay, and then let me just do it again. Sorry. So I've got the forthcoming events. Here we go. Here. Can you see that now? No, can you see? Anyway, let me read it for you. So basically, next Tuesday, the Horsham Future Forum starts up again. And we've got the Horsham Community Fridge coming along to talk about what they're doing in Horsham. And then there'll be an opportunity to chat at the end. We do have a couple of other Tuesday evening talks taking place, which I will include in an email for you. But our plan from October onwards is to, as long as none of our regular attendees, this doesn't work for you, is to actually run the Horsham Future Forum on a Wednesday evening. The Youth Eco Forum can't really do Tuesday evenings. It's not good for Christ Hospital. We have a lot of pupils from Christ Hospital. And so they are currently running on a Wednesday evening, and it's just much easier to market, albeit they want separate meeting. They don't want to run at the same in the same meeting. We used to have breakout rooms for the Youth Eco Forum and the Horsham Future Forum, but it would be easier to still have the two meetings running using two separate Zoom meetings on a Wednesday night. So our proposal from October is to have a speaker every other week, and then just networking of us local people talking about what is going on, what are actions we can get out there and encourage others to take part in, which will be a lot easier to organise as well. So, please spread the word. We really do need to, for the sakes of our children, our grandchildren and all who we share this great planet with, we really do need to get more people engaged. One of the talks that's coming up actually is about the green grants, which the government are actually, so the 22nd of September, there's going to be a talk actually by Open Eco Homes about the green grants that are currently available, up to £5,000 match funded money for clean renewable solutions to clean up, green up and retrofit our homes. So there are lots of great solutions out there. But yeah, just need to sort of share them out and get people embracing these opportunities. Does anyone have anything else to add before we go? Yes, Morag?
Yes, I just wanted to say that on Friday and Saturday next week, I'm launching the Friends of the Rec, F-R-E-C, FREC. And it's the little Victory Road recreation grounds between Greenway and Trafalgar Schools, and it's mainly a cricket and football field, but there's little patches of greenery around it that I'm trying to get a bit more TLC for, so that we're having a working party launch 10 till 12 and again 2 till 4 on Friday and 10 till 12 on Saturday. That's the 11th and 12th. So if anybody wants to share that or come along with hand tools and gloves and empty compost bags for carting the waste around, that would be very much appreciated.
Yeah, we'll share the details with, and I can just put it in an email to if right. I collate all these together and the recording. Yeah,
thank you.
So thank you ever so much, Natalie. Thank you very much indeed, Joanne. I hope everybody has something to take away from this and to share with others. So don't forget, if you want flowers, don't buy them from the supermarket with plastic when they've been blown in refrigeration with chemicals and everything else. Find someone local like Natalie in Coolham and go and buy them from her garden. There are lots of people out there. And and let's try and help make West Sussex peat free. Ask the question, you know, you're right. When we buy pots of flower pots, plants and vegetables, it doesn't say whether the compost in those pots is peat free. So even by asking the question of the garden centres, that's going to actually help to raise awareness when Joanne then goes in there and sorts them out. So yep. So thank you very much, everybody. Have a really lovely Saturday afternoon, and hopefully see some of you next Tuesday or at the next Horsham Climate Cafe, which is a really good one actually in October. It's Paul Hannan, who's an amazing expert, academic, environmentalist and author of a book called Significance. And he's talking about the new human story, or the new story, if humans want to survive and evolve as a species. Really good talk. So thank you one and all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you everybody. Really interesting.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I think we need to, or does Natalie or Joanne want to say anything, wrap up?
No, but thank you so much, Carrie, for the opportunity to do this.
Oh, well, God, you know, one thing I meant to say, Joanne, is I know it's slightly separate from you now, but your apples, everyone's got apples on the floor. I want to find out when you're doing your apple weekends.
I'll get the dates from Rachel and I'll let you know.
Please do, because the apples are falling from my tree. They're huge. And Alison's tree as well.
Okay.
We need to cider process them.
Okay, I'll have a word with her and find out when it is. The as you know, the cider apples are later than a lot of table apples and garden apples. So unfortunately, we'll do the best. You know, she wants your apples, but
yeah,
I will let you know.
Well, when do you think you will let me know? Because I could put it in this email, because I meant to mention it to everybody about apples.
All right, I'll email her. I'll text her now. She's not about, but I'll text her and find out when it's happening.
Okay, then if you know, I can put it in the email.
Absolutely, that would be great.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Alison. Are you going to do a little save to the cloud or save to... You're on mute. I can't hear you. I can't hear. You're on mute. Can't hear.
I think I've saved it. I hope I've saved it.
Okay. All right. Well, ladies, if Alison's managed to save it, we'll download it and we'll upload it to Sussex Green Living with all these links. Oh, I have